Good evening. Hey, all right. We're alive tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you to the Arthur Brown Memorial Celebration. Thank you.
poet who died young. J.D. Parry. A poet who died young for Arthur Brown, 1947 to 1982. He knew the song the goldfish sang in his window world, the slow ripple of a lover, the sad, triumphant music of the caged bird. He knew and reached through the window, the world, the cage of the body, writing a Bab Kabbalah on the empty notebook pages, writing out of June bug flashings, noting the difference between cement and concrete, growling out improvisations of the belly, terrablue afternoons, blowing the logic of the gone Buddy Bolden's trumpet, the preacher's clean scat, Charlie Parker's precise needling. What could language do to cut through itself? He knew his job was to poet. The words spoke through him from all over, through time too, when he was really there, ready, in the flow, when the words were heady and moist in the corners of his mouth. Then it was nothing but love, nothing but love. And he knew then he was immortal and that he was destined to die with a lopsided smile like Michelangelo. And he thought death might not be all that bad, except for the living. Well, we're here. We welcome you to celebrate the life, words, and words we carry on of Arthur Brown's. We're really gathered here together. All of the artists participating knew Arthur, worked with him, respected him, and were inspired by him. And many in the audience can say the same things about. Arthur was among the original group of poets who began the readings here in Duff's in 1975. And January after he passed, he was slated to be here to receive the Missouri Biennial Poetry Prize. So this is not a wake, this is a celebration as always. That was J.D. Parin, who's our special musical guest in from New York, who grew up with Arthur and is here to pay tribute. Also on the program, as you know, is Shirley LaFleur. For those of you who don't know Shirley, she also is in from the New York area, longtime mainstay of poetry in St. Louis, a great teacher who worked with many young writers and dramatists through her work with the Black Artists Group in the 60s and then through the Creative Arts and Expression Laboratory in the 70s. Now she's quite busy in New York. I'm just going to say a little bit about each artist, and then I'm just going to let the evening flow. So Shirley will be with us. I want you to know she's been living in New York since 1992 and is quite busy there. She's been reading at places like the New Eurekan Cafe. Just this past November, she, along with J.D., performed at Carnegie Hall. J.D. composed a piece for Shirley's poems, Angels, Dragons, and Unicorn. So Shirley is here along with J.D. Glenn Popper Wright is with us, the great percussionist, master of CASA, and Glenn is Papa is one of the most busy musicians in the city. He's working with a trio. He's working with puppetry. He's working with storytellers and poets. You can hear him all over town. Maurice Kenny is with us. We do regret that Maurice Malik King is unable to be with us as scheduled due to a back problem. We know he's here in spirit, and we know he really wishes he could be playing for us all. We wish him a swift recovery, and we want him here next year. We're going to begin with the other great poet on our bill, Maurice Kenney. Maurice has come to us also from New York, upstate New York, where he lives in Saranac Lake in northern New York, which is near his birthplace and home on the reservation of the Six Nations. Maurice is Mohawk by heritage. If you talk to anybody about the Native American writers that are active today, Maurice is always among the first to those who follow the writing in this field come out with. More than that, he's one of the finest poets of his generation, as Wendy Rose has said. He's the author of over 20 books. Most recently, Between Two Rivers, his selected poems, came out from White Pine Press. His most recent volume is called Tecum Watonte, Molly Brandt, which is a historical poem. Some of you may have seen the recent movie on TNT regarding the Six Nations. The name escapes me right now. But Molly Brandt was a character in that film who was really not given her due. But Maurice has written several historical persona poems dealing with the history of the Iroquois Nation. And that is one of them, a marvelous, marvelous work. Maurice was also a pioneer in the field of multiculturalism and multicultural literature through his work with the magazine Contact 2 out of New York, which was just published its perhaps final issue after close to 20 years of publication. He has a special connection with this evening because, as I mentioned, he knew Arthur, he supported his work, and as a publisher, through his Contact 2 Press, he published a book called Mississippi River Poems by Arthur Brown, which just came out in 1990 and is a wonderful collection. We have also on hand the earlier volume that River Styx put out, Trumpet in the Morning. So, those are the people who are going to be performing up here. My name is Michael Castro. I know many of you. I'm the director of the series here. I want to especially welcome Arthur's mother, Mrs. White, and the Brown family who are here with us at the table. And we're really happy, as always, that you're here. Okay, we're ready to open our ears, open our hearts. Please give a warm welcome to Maurice Kenney.
Back, Arthur. Last time I remember seeing Arthur in this room, he was sitting over there against the wall, and I was reading the big poem, right? And he fell asleep, fell off the chair. I didn't speak to him for a couple of years after that. Rain by magic, rain by song. Rain by colors, rain by dance. Mountains move, give space to clouds. Rain by magic, rain by song. Rain by song, rain by song. Rain by song, rain, rain, rain by song. Several years ago, I went out to the Oneida people in Wisconsin to do a series of workshops with the children at the Oneida Reservation School. And this one day, this little girl walked up to me, little tiny thing, and she said, "I want to take your writing workshop." "Well, come in." "They won't let me." Why not? They told me I don't have any imagination. Well, come in and let's find out. That morning it had rained. And outside of the room where we were doing the workshop was this huge elm tree. And below it was a mud puddle, a huge mud puddle. And the tree was reflected onto the mud puddle. And Ruthie wrote a poem. Not the usual rains like gumdrops falling out of the sky stuff. Nah, she did have an imagination. She said, rain is like pumpkin pies falling out of the sky. Because she had looked out and she'd seen this tree. And the reflection looked like pumpkin pies falling out of the tree. Well, the next day, this other lad walked up, another little guy. And he said, I want to take your workshop too. Well, come on in. No, they won't let me. Why not? They told me I was daffy. Daffy? Daffy? He said, I see dinosaurs out in the woods. I said, I think you had a very rich imagination. I think you should be in this workshop. So he did. He came in. And later that first day in the workshop, he said, come on out with me and see the dinosaurs. So when I left Oneida, I wrote this poem for him, In the Vines, for Oakley in Wisconsin at Oneida Nation. Voices. He heard voices painted on the belly of the bridge over Duck Creek. He knew they were a people, nation. Voices talking of the vines of wild strawberries crawling along the creek edge of the white pink trilliums spattering the woods floor, snows of spring. A voice urging him to tramp the ferns and mosquitoes of the woods, looking for dinosaur eggs large as Olmec head sculptures. He knew their haunts, voices, writings, and we sat below the bridge listening, listening, and all I heard were the scrawls. I love Kim and BIA, go home. He asked what they said. He knew they were a people, nation, stranger amongst strangers, perhaps lost, hungry, wounded. How could I explain? His hands were so fragile. How could I tell him who they were? He was a spring blossom himself. How could I bring heartbreak to his fantasy, his boy smile, his 6 years as he sat anxious, believing, and listening as the berry vines curled around his ankles and wrists? I went back to Wisconsin this past spring, and he was no longer a little boy. He was big. He was tall. And I did about 20 readings in the area and workshops, and he attended every single one of them. He's not only a football player in the high school team, but he's a poet as well. That pleased me to no end. I was growing up in northern New York. My dad was a pretty good hunter and a pretty good fisherman, and we ate the food that he caught, his game, rabbits, pheasant, deer, salmon, trout, whatever. And of course, you know, if you have a father who is a hunter and a fisherman and he has a son or two, he wants his son to follow in his tracks, right? Sometimes injustice. The day I was born, my father bought me a .22. A year later, my mother traded it for a violin. 10 years later, my big sister traded that for a guitar and gave it to her boyfriend who sold it. Now you know why I never learned to hunt or learned how to play a musical instrument, or became a Wall Street broker. many of you here may be familiar with the name Annie Mae Aguash. She was a Mi'kmaq woman from Maine who, during the confrontation at Wounded Knee in 1973 and 74, left her home to go to South Dakota to, in a sense, join AIM, American Indian Movement, and become part of that confrontation, fighting for the rights of the Lakota people and, of course, all Native people on this earth, on this land. The government was doing some nasty things, as it's been known to do over the many years of this country. And in 1976, she came missing. She came up missing. And 6 months later, after she was missed, they found her body out on the plains in South Dakota in a gulch with a bullet through her skull. The FBI and the CIA had been hunting her down, thinking that she had all this great knowledge of where the next confrontation was going to take place. She didn't. What she was doing there at Wounded Knee was taking care of the children, seeing that they were fed, they had milk, and they were being educated. She had no extra information. Some very wise and intelligent person made a film, a documentary on her life some years later, and I was lucky enough to be teaching at the University of Oklahoma at the time the film was being played, and I saw it, and I wrote this poem, The Hands of Annie Mae Aguash, for Cammy and Elizabeth, women of courage and conviction, 1976. Out of a dark Dakota cold and snow, they rise finger by fingertip, inked in blood to print on skulls, indelibly of those who own no heart, drawn from ancient wells of a million veins, blood close to the skin surface, hands cut at the wrists by foreign tricksters, masters of medieval torture who school the world in depravity, masters starved for flesh and broken bones, strive to keep breath in Salem in the hot acts from human pain, 1989. Child of old America, girl of fervor, youth of freedom, woman of conscience, Annie Mae, what good are my tears, sorrow, watching the camera move across snows and shadows of your hour, rage blind sight of what action to take as I home Oklahoma now, temporarily this autumn eve of October, in a hall whispering your vision, resounding the language of your voice, students' heads bowed by shame, in the horror too startled by your murder to protest. They have seen Sand Creek, my lie, and now the massacre of you, mind raped and spirit, head crushed after the gunshot, hands severed at the wrist from their duty, packaged in sawdust and shipped to the Capitol for further contamination. All you ever wanted was milk in your breasts for the children, corn and rabbit for the generations, cleanliness of the earth for naked feet to touch while dancing in the belly of their mother. Freedom from want, is that too much to ask? Respect for a grave, respect for a prayer, respect respect for the first moon and the first sun rising slowly over Turtle's back. Rage is not sufficient. I kiss those severed fingers one by one, hoping to suck out your courage and defiance, your strength, a seed to replant, harvest, to nourish the very young of the people, all the people. Finger by fingertip, I kiss the flesh and suck the blood which spurts from your life as long as drums bang and songs remain the essence of humankind. I lay this prayer feather on your figurative grave, knowing well rage is not enough, nor revenge satisfactory. I'm a very heavy-duty coffee drinker. I just got my cup and left it over there by mistake. And one summer, I was up on the reservation staying with my cousin and his wife on Cornwall Island, which is actually on the Canadian side of the border of the reservation that crosses through the reservation. And they knew my need, my total addiction for coffee. And I go to bed fairly early, and they go to bed fairly late. I get up quite early, and they get up quite late. And this one night, they decided they would play a trick on me. They hid the coffee. I rise at 5 a.m., and I am a bear if I don't get my coffee immediately. Well, I tried to find it. I couldn't find it. I couldn't even find the grounds from the night before. I went through the garbage, everything. So I went outside in the front yard. By then, the light was up, and I sat down and I wrote this poem. And I thought at the time it was a very angry poem that I had gotten even with them for doing this. Now I read the poem over, and I say, I really didn't get even at all, except I got a pretty good poem out of it. Listening for the elders. Is summer this bear? Home this tamarack? Are these wild berries' song? Is this hill where my grandmother sleeps? This river where my father fishes? Does this winter house light its window for me, burn oak for my chill? Does this woman sing my pain? Does this drum beat sounding waters? Or does this crow caw? Does this hickory nut fall? This corn ripen, this field yellow, this prayer feather hang, this mother worry, this ghost walk? Does this fire glow, this bat swoop, this night fall? Does this star shine over mountains for this cousin who has no aunt picking sweet grass for a pillow? Is summer this wolf, this elm leaf, this pipe smoke? Is summer this turtle, home this sumac, home this black ash? Is summer this story? Is summer home? Is twilight home? Is summer this tongue? Home this cedar? These snakes in my hair? Reflection on this sky? This summer day? This bear? I can't but believe that a number of you people here in the room know the fine Cheyenne poet Lance Henson. And he came into New York, I was living in New York City some years back, and looked around and stayed in my house and looked around. I was living in Brooklyn, and I thought Brooklyn was a pretty good place to live. And he looked around and he said something like, how can any self-respecting Mohawk live in a place like this? And I said, you know, one of these days I got to get even with this guy, and if I can find this bloody poem, I'll try to read it. They tell me I'm lost for Lance Henson. My feet are elms, roots in the earth. My heart is the hawk. My thought the arrow that rides the wind across the valley. My spirit eats with eagles on the mountain crag and clashes with the thunder. The grass is the breath of my flesh, and the deer is the bone of my child. My toes dance in the drum, the light of the eyes of the old turtle. My chant is the wind. My chant is the muskrat. My chant is the seed. My chant is the tadpole. My chant is the grandfather and his many grandchildren, sired in the frost of March and the summer noon of brown August. My chant is the field that turns with the sun and feeds the mice and the bare red berries and honey. My chant is the river that quenches the thirst of the sun. My chant is the woman who bore me and my blood and my flesh of tomorrow. My chant is the herb that heals and the moon that moves the tide and the wind that cleans the earth of old bones singing in the morning dust. My chant is the rabbit, skunk, heron. My chant is the red willow, the clay, and the great pine that bulges the woods, and the axe that fells the birch, and the hand that breaks the corn from the stalk, and waters a squash and catches stars. My chant is a blessing to the trout, beaver, and a blessing to the young pheasant that warms my winter. My chant is the wolf in the dark. My chant is the crow flying against the sun. My chant is the sun, sleeping on the back of the grass in marriage. My chant is the sun. While there is sun, I cannot be lost. My chant is the quaking of the earth, angry and bold. Although I hide in the thick forest or the deep pool of the slow river, though I hide in a shack, a prison, though I hide in a word, a law, though I hide in a glass of beer and or high on steel girders over the city or in the slums of that city, though I hide in a mallard feather or the petals of the milkwort or a story told by my father, though there are eyes that do not see me and ears that do not hear my drum or hands that do not feel my wind and tongues which do not taste my blood, I am the shadow on the field, the rain on the rock, the snow on the wind, the footprint on the water, the vetch on the grave. I am the sweat on the boy, the smile on the woman, the paint on the man. I am the singer of songs and the hunter of fox. I am the glare on the sun, the frost on the fruit, the notch on the cedar. I am the foot and the golden snake. I am the foot and the silver snake. I am the tongue of the wind and the nourishment of grubs. I am the claw and the hoof and the shell. I am the stalk and the bloom and the pollen. I am the boulder on the rim of the hill. I am the sun and the moon, the light and the dark. I am the shadow on the field. I am the string, the bow, and the arrow. Sometimes when you look around and you see all these books you've published and get kind of big-headed and all that kind of crazy stuff, and then something happens and you learn, you know, you're not so great after all. I try to go home to the reserve in June every year. It's kind of like a family weekend, and everyone comes back to the reservation who lives off. And it's a marvelous weekend. There's a lot of traditional dancing and traditional foods and lots of music. And so in summer of 84, I went back. And when I returned to New York City, to Brooklyn, I wrote this poem. Friendship Days at Akwesasne, summer of 84. Humid afternoon by the St. Lawrence River, Women canoe racers paddled the river, full of fry bread, soda, and hot strawberry rhubarb pie. I stumble under the cedar arbor to listen to the drum and the singing. Outfitted Mohawks circle a stomp dance. I take a place on a bench near an elder woman who asks in Mohawk, "What do I do?" Tote bag slung over my left shoulder, I figure I should own up. I'm a writer in smiles. "What kind?" she asked, really curious. "A poet," I replied proudly, to which she offered a grunt, got up from the bench, and huffed off. Well, maybe she was right. Doesn't hurt to laugh at ourselves once in a while. And, you know, Mohawk ladies have a way of bringing you down to reality. Believe me, they do. Yeah? How much you make for that poem? Nothing, right? Get a job. Any job. Greyhounding to Billings, Montana. "Hey, you Indian?" I nodded. "Hey, you! You Indian?" His cowboy hat fell into the beer can in his lap as he turned to his seat companion reading a Superman comic. "I rode from Chicago to Minneapolis with these two dudes. I thought they were greasers." He topped his head again with the hat and sipped his beer. "They were real live Apaches." I stood waiting to get into the bus bathroom. "Hey, I asked you if you was Indian." "Mohawk." "From back east?" He sipped his beer again. "Man, it's good sitting next to normal person." And he slouched in his seat. I agreed, closing the bathroom door and turned on the bright light. I was gone on that trip to various schools on various reservations up in the area. And when I went back to Billings, he was still sitting in the bus station and he was still drunk. I think he might still be there. Some years ago, I was very fortunate to be asked, one of four Mohawk men, to go into the Adirondack Mountains where I presently live, and an old dugout canoe, really very old, possibly 700, possibly 800 years old, long before contact with Europeans. And in those days, they took these big trees and then they started to pound them, and then they would burn out the center and pound more and burn out more until they finally had a hollow in the dugout that could be used as a boat. And in one of the ponds in the Adirondacks called Twin Ponds, one of these boats rose up out of the mud where it had been anchored down for who knows how many hundreds of years. And as I said, I was one of four Mohawk men, to go over and check out this dugout. And when I touched the canoe, the dugout, a piece of the wood fell off in my hand. And I carried that piece of wood in my hand for a long time. And every time I'd hold it out, it would quiver as though it were still alive. And I sat down and I wrote a very long 16-page poem. I'm not going to read it all, but I'm going to read part of it. And this poem is really more of a chant, I guess, than a poem. And it really deals with Mother Earth. Now, first, may I have a drink of water? My mother is a turtle. My mother is a fish. My mother is a muskrat. My mother is a beaver. My mother is a boat. My mother is a reed. My mother is my mother, and all her parts are me. My mother is a fish. My mother is a reed. My mother is corn and bean and squash. My mother is sumac and smoke. My mother is honey. My mother is a berry and the bramble. My mother is the sap of the maple. My mother is a boat. My mother is the rapid in a stream. My mother is the wind. My mother is a coot. My mother is a bear. My mother is this house. My mother is the fire. I am my mother, and my mother is me. My mother is a fish, 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 is a fish. My mother is a bone, is a bone, is a bone, is a bone, is a bone. My mother is yarrow. My mother is hawkweed. My mother is a deer. My mother is a snipe. My mother is a blue heron. My mother is a yellow rose. My mother is a sprig of mint. My mother is a birch. My mother is a cedar that sings in the wind. My mother is a cloud. My mother is a star, is a star, is a star, is a star, is a star. My mother is a dream, is a dream. My mother is a grave. My mother is a wolf. My mother is water. My mother is loam. My mother is fire. My mother is wind. My mother is a fish. I am my mother. My mother is me, is me, is me, is a bone, is a bone, is yarrow, is yarrow, is hawkweed, is a deer, is a snipe, a blue heron, a yellow rose, a sprig of mint, is a birch, is a cedar in the cloud, is a star, is a dream, is a grave, is a wolf, is water, is loam, is fire. I am my mother, and my mother is me. Please, may I have a drink of water? I have been living with two women. Unusual? Well, not really. One woman was dead while I lived with her. And I lived with her for 12 years. And the other woman I lived with just died December 18th. She was my cat. We just buried her. But the woman I lived with for 12 years, who was dead, she was actually a spirit, was a woman, a Mohawk woman, born in 1735. Pretty kinky to live with a dead body that long, eh? She's been dead all those many years. Her name was Tekonwadonte, Molly Brandt, sister of the famed Joseph Brandt, wife of the famed Sir William Johnson. Some of you historian buffs who know anything about New York State will know that it was because of Sir William Johnson that we speak English in the United States rather than French, because he fought the battle at Lake George during the French and Indian War. I don't know why they call it Indian War. We didn't cause it. We didn't start it. We did help to end it, though. And he pushed the French back north into Canada at that battle. And because of him, we speak English. So he's a pretty famous guy. The fathers of our country, whoever they were, the George Washingtons, those guys, they weren't very good fathers, I don't think, but that's beside the point. Don't watch television. They lie about George. He was a mean, nasty old bastard, let's face the fact. Yeah, really. I'll even applaud to that. He hated Indians probably more than General George Armstrong Custer did, and he killed a lot more Indians than General George Armstrong Custer did. Anyway, Sir William Johnson, about the age of 35, he met this most remarkable and very beautiful young woman, Tekonwadonte, in the streets of German Flats, which was a little village back in the 1700s, and he fell madly in love with her and married her. Well, he'd already had two wives. One was her aunt, who had died in childbirth, Caroline, and another was a young German girl that he'd bought for $15 from a farmer. She was an indentured servant brought over from Germany. And he lived with her for 10 years, and he didn't marry her and actually until the night she died. At the same time, he was married in native ceremony to this other woman, Molly Brandt, Tecon Wadonte, who gave him 8 children. He liked women a whole lot, and he liked them quite young. Molly was 15 when he married her, and Katharina, the German girl, was 15 when he bought her. And Caroline, Molly's aunt, was also 15 when he married her. What would we call that today? Almost child abuse, eh? It's been said by some of the historians that Sir William Johnson fathered over 200 children, not by the same woman. But he met Molly, as I said, when she was about 15, and he fell madly in love with her, swept her off her feet. She also fell madly in love with him, and they were married, as I said, ceremonial, and lived together for 21 years, and she gave him 8 children. He was pretty much the macho dude. He did like his ladies, and he did like his rum, and he did like stealing land from the Indian people, the Iroquois people, and he would take as much as he possibly could. There was a story that talking with Chief Hendricks one morning, Chief Hendricks got up and they were walking through the woods, and he said to Sir William, "Sir William, I had a dream last night." "You did, sir? What did you dream?" He said, "Sir William, I dreamt that you gave me that beautiful red jacket you're wearing." Well, in Iroquois custom, if somebody has a dream of that nature, you have to do it or you're in a lot of trouble with the spirit world. So Sir William took off this beautiful new red jacket and gave it to Chief Hendricks. And they keep walking along, and finally Sir William said to Chief Hendricks, "Chief Hendricks, I forgot." He said, "I had a dream last night too." "I bet you did," Chief Hendricks said. And he said, "I dreamt that you gave me as much land on the south side of the Mohawk River as I could walk in a morning." Now, he was still a very young man, and you know how far he could walk. So that's the way he got the land from the Iroquois people. This is a persona poem, a dramatic monologue in Sir William's voice. William, his daily journal. "What more could a man ask? Fields cleaned of rocks, a stout horse, a warm cabin, a comely woman with strong hips holding a plate of roast venison in the doorway under a pleasant Macintosh smile. Kingdoms are for kings. Victory and domination for generals. Spoils and rapine for malcontents. Thrill of saber rutting through flesh is for sick minds. Mercenaries faulted at birth, too long in the womb, too long entangled in the afterbirth and the smell of their own blood. Truly, do I thirst? Tremble at night at the sight of unclaimed woods, woods which do not echo the sounds of axe striking bark, earth unplowed, seedless, a womb virgin having borne neither phallic plow nor fruit. Women, yes, oh, women, the greatest gift of God. Greater than breath itself, sweet breasts, rolls of belly flesh, hot loins, passionate groins, growls and groans of pleasure as I mount, enter, wallow, pumping my blood semen into their centuries, my own cries renting the night or the shine of afternoon on a hayfield, or the waters of some slow river, caught in the orgiastic ecstasy of total being naked, naked before me, before the reeds of the marsh, the blossoms of the peach orchard, the flight of the crow, naked before the winds of time, before flesh sweet as berry, as the sap of maple, naked before all the eyes of the woods. Ah, women. I'll round thy belly to 100 suns, woman and land. The earth is a fallow woman, its portals dark and mysterious, yielding the zenith and stratospheric music which men only hear when eyes are closed, chest and thighs sticky in lustful sweat, mucilaged to the fat of her scented flesh, writhing in groans, tendering her to orgasms. Shut up. Be content with a single woman or a single field, a horse which will one day stumble under the plow and render itself useless. Over in Pennsylvania. And Gettysburg College is just a few miles away from Carlisle School that had been an Indian boarding school back in the, from 1879 to 1918. And while I was there at the school, the college, the young woman who was a coordinator of the program brought in this big box of old photographs. And she wanted me to go through them. And they were all the native children who had been at this school. And I went through them, and this one picture just stopped me dead. And I kept staring at it and staring at it and staring at it. And she finally said, "When are you going to write the poem?" Photograph, Carlisle Indian School, 1879-1918. I hear ancient drums in your eyes. See dances on the mouth. Why is this teenage boy stiff in the shutter? Punishment, pain on the cheek, loss in folded hands. Who is this boy, nationless, nondescript in an army uniform, devoid of hair feather, fetish, and pain? Stiff young sapling rising from some eastern wood, straight as a Duwamish totem, tall as a southwestern Mesa Pueblo, collar so tight it proclaims a hanging. No pemmican or jerky or parched corn in the clenched fist that your mother gave to eat on the road to Pennsylvania, where Delaware once built long houses, made fires, loved in furs, fished rivers, praised the Creator for boundless beauty. Who is this boy? Hair cut, tongue cut. Whose youthful warrior braids lie heaped on the barber's floor, spine straightened by General Pratt. Rules of order. Ancient image scattered over forested hills, so many leaves from a dying apple tree. Who is this teenaged boy? With eyes cold in utter fear, mouth vised and shut, a prayer and song, whose thin legs tremble within the army trousers, arms quiver in dread of the unexpected. An instructor standing off from the flash of the insensitive camera, demanding compliance. There should be a flute to his lips, making songs,
music of love. There should be a lance in his grip to take home game. There should be a future on the roll of his dark cheek. There should be a vision quest in his spirit, a name given for honorable deeds, a drawing of the deed on stretched skin of the winter count calendar. He stands before the photographer, amalgamated in uniform and shaved head. He stands compromised before his teachers. All that is left to him, which is him, beaded moccasins below the cuffs of his pants. But the beadwork so faint in the photo, his great nation cannot be phantomed. It can be guessed only that probably the supply room ran out of army shoes the morning his wagon arrived at the boarding school. Who is this lad? He has no name, no land, no nation. Is he Jim Thorpe, Louis Tawanama? Where was he born? When was he born? Who is his father, his uncle, his siblings? Who is the mother who suckled him at breast? Is this boy entombed in the unmarked grave of the military institute which won so many wars by bringing so many proud children to their knees? I listen for the drum in your eyes. Wait to see the dance on your mouth. All I hear are your bitter cries of anguish. He has no only a reflection. His is one of the many spirits which will forever roam this once free and beautiful land before it came to be America. This photograph, a reminder of this nameless boy. Who is he? My grandfather. Thank you.